WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. I'm filling in for Steve. My name is Don Nolan. I'm a frequent substitute for Steve in this program, and Steve is out of town this afternoon, and we are privileged to talk to a very distinguished scholar on Islam who has written a new book entitled The Future of Islam, about which we're going to discuss. He was here recently at the University of Illinois to give a lecture on this general topic. His name is Professor John Esposito. Professor Esposito, are you on the line?
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
No problem.
You are usually billed as one of America's leading authorities on Islam. You have written 35 books on the subject, such books with titles as Holy War, What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam, Islamophobia, and today we're going to be talking about a new book that you have published. I think you've been working on it, as I recall reading, since 9/11, The Future of Islam. Have you been working on it that long?
Yeah, well, until about 2 years ago, and then it went into production.
Right. And you have essentially pulled together a great many of your observations and research from many other books into this book, as I understand it. And in one of your interviews, you said this is the toughest book you've had to write. Do you still believe that?
Yeah, definitely.
Why is that?
Well, after 9/11, I thought that I would probably write a new concluding chapter to a book I had done and which did very well, called The Islamic Threat Myth of Reality. But OUP asked me to do a different book dealing with 9/11 and bin Laden, and so I did that. And then I did a book called What Everyone Needs to Know About Islam. But the problem was, from about 9/11 on, that the situation was so fluid that trying to get back to the future of Islam became, in many ways, very difficult. And then getting into it and trying to figure out how you could both draw off the past, because people needed a background, but also point to the future in a situation that was changing every day, was a bit of a challenge. But eventually it got done.
Yeah, that's been a bit of a pressure cooker, I should imagine, talking about Islam in this country since 9/11. Is that right?
Yeah. If it was a problem before, just before 9/11, it was much more difficult after that, because in contrast to actions committed by Christian and Jewish extremists and the natural response that one would expect from the average American that, well, you know, these are extremists, therefore it doesn't represent the religion or the majority of people, that simply didn't happen in terms of many people in the U.S. In fact, the data shows that whereas Americans were more positively responsive right after 9/11, within 2 or 3 years, everything went south and has continued to go south in terms of attitudes, fears, and even anti-Islam and anti-Muslim bias.
Well, there's a long history of stereotypes that you have spoken about in previous work. Most prominent are the old Hollywood stereotypes of Islam getting merged, images of Muslims being merged together with Sikhs and even Hindus and others. My perception is that the stereotypes are very much there, but they have taken different forms. Is the stereotype of Muslim/terrorist still strong, according to the
data? Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think that, if you look at, for example, the hysteria over the building of an Islamic center, which would be the equivalent of building a Jewish center, which does exist in Manhattan, and building one in New York, and then suddenly saying it's a ground zero when it really wasn't,
right,
and describing it as a mosque, but not just a mosque, but describing anything that would be built as a monument to terrorism, and then after that, finding that across the country, you suddenly had communities where if people wanted to express a concern about the building of a mosque and even be prejudiced about it, they'd say something like, well, it's going to affect the traffic pattern. And in fact, they adopted the phrase from Park 51 and just said to build a mosque is to build a monument to terrorism. Then we had the congressional elections when we found that it wasn't just redneck politicians appealing to redneck voters, but mainstream politicians like Newt Gingrich and members of Congress and others seeking to be elected to Congress or governor suddenly engaging in not just the denunciation of terrorists, which is what you would expect. I mean, that's what you want. But in fact, saying things as Gingrich did, that to build an Islamic center anywhere in Manhattan, as it were, was the equivalent of having Nazis demonstrate outside the Holocaust Museum.
Right. Funny things happen when you designate ground such as Ground Zero as sacred.
Yeah.
Well, this is a call-in show, and let me just remind our listeners that you can call in and talk with Professor Esposito about the subject of his book, which has been out for 2 years now, but he recently came to the University of Illinois to talk about the future of Islam. If you'd like to talk to Professor Esposito, ask a question or make a comment, you can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 800-222-9455. Now, Professor Esposito, you are also a founding director of the Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding. That's in Georgetown, right?
Yeah, correct.
Where you are University Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University. Can you talk a little bit about your center?
Yeah. The center was created actually in 1993, and at that time had nothing to do with Prince Al-Waleed. It was created at Georgetown in 1993 and was funded by a group of Christian, Arab Christian, and Muslim businessmen. In particular, the leader of the group was Hasib Sabag, who was a Palestinian Catholic, in effect, in terms of his background. And the whole idea was to address the whole question of, at the end of the Cold War, what was the next threat? And there were those who thought Japan would be an economic threat and the EU, and then there were those who thought that there was a clash of civilization. Sam Huntington was the chief proponent of that.
Right.
And so the center was created to address that issue. Because the concern of these businessmen was that there ought to be a distinction, as indeed years later President George W. Bush said, and more recently President Barack Obama, that one needs to distinguish between the acts of terrorists and what the mainstream religion and the majority of their followers believe. So that's why the center was created in 93. And it was very the response was extraordinarily intense. I mean, we were like overwhelmed with requests for us to speak, to write, to travel all over the world.
Before 9/11.
Yeah. But when 9/11 came along, as one of my international advisors said, however successful we were in establishing ourselves internationally, 9/11 in terms of what our issue and mission was, had set us back about 20 years. And I had thought at the time that was an exaggeration. I thought, well, maybe 5 to 10. But I think that was an accurate assessment, because if you look at hard data from the Gallup World Poll, for example, and other polls done by Gallup and Pew and other organizations. The reality of it is that after 9/11, as I said earlier, the response from many Americans was fairly even-handed and supportive. But within several years, the attitude became more and more negative. And that is, you more and more saw, for example, when Americans were asked, what do you admire about Islam or Muslims? Not terrorists, but Islam or Muslims. 57% said nothing or I don't know. And significant percentages of Americans doubted whether Muslims could be loyal citizens. Significant numbers said that there ought to be special identity markers. So, and we see that continuing, as I said, down into the debates around Park 51 and then the recent elections for Congress, and even now in the workup to potential presidential elections.
When you say Park 51, you mean the New York Center?
Exactly, right. Mm-hmm. The so-called mosque at Ground Zero.
Yeah. Well, just one more reminder to our guest. If you'd like to call in to ask a question or make a comment about the future of Islam, the title of a book by Professor John Esposito, who is with us today on Keeping the Faith, you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Now, it's been one of your long-term scholarly aims, and I assume of the center as well, to educate Americans and Westerners in general about, among other things, the diversity in Islam, and to try to get Americans to stop asking the same questions before 9/11 that they're asking after 9/11. Your work, as I understand it, is trying to get us to learn more and to look deeper into what Islam is. Why don't we just start off, if we could, with your book. It's divided into four parts, and the first part focuses on the basics. Tell us a little bit about why Islam is not homogeneous, why it is just as diverse, if not more so, than, say, Christianity or other great world religions.
Well, you know, when you look at Islam as a religion, you know, many Muslims, like many Catholics, for example, or many Christians more generally, you know, will talk as if one is talking about one expression of Islam. But the fact is that if those of us who are Catholic know that the difference between African expressions of Catholicism, whether it's liturgy, in a variety of ways, you know, is different from America because there's a whole cultural context. And so if you go to a liturgy, one can immediately see it in terms of the music, in terms of the idiom that's used. And certainly if one talks about Christianity vis-a-vis Islam, we know there's an enormous diversity. Islam is not as diverse as Christianity. I mean, Christianity goes from, if you will, very conservative Trinitarians or very conservative literalist interpreters of the Bible to Unitarians and very, very pluralistic, liberal, whatever you want to use as a term, interpretations of Scripture. But if you look at Islam as a religion, there are many different groups. You not only have Sunni and Shia that are two largest groups. Sunni are about 85% of the world's Muslims, Shia about 15%. But you have many theological schools with distinctive differences. In fact, they not only have differences that they accept, they have differences that they vie with each other over. You know, the way in which, let's say, Lutherans and Catholics might, you know, have differences theologically, and many different law schools. And then within the tradition, you also have, as with all religions, what I call the transcendent side of religion, which is a religion that points to a transcendent reality that goes beyond a human nature and the human experience and also helps us to make ourselves better or transcend ourselves. But there's also the dark side of religion. That we see in Christian cults, that we see in warfare committed in the name of Christianity, and similar activities that occur within Islam as they do within Judaism today. So Islam is a lot more diverse than we think. I think part of the problem is that when you don't know much about anything, if you don't know much about a religion, or if you don't know much about an ethnic group, you tend to presume that they're all the same. So, you know, if you meet, if you know nothing about anybody who's Irish or Polish or whatever, Ukrainian, and you meet one, two, or three people or families, if you're not careful, you'll generalize and think, well, that's the way they all are.
Right.
And we do that with religions. We do that in a variety of ways. And I think that as a result, for many people, particularly those who don't take the time to do some reading and thinking about it, they just sort of, you know, think of, quote, the other in this kind of monolithic way. And, you know, when you really think about the way in which, for example, even in our own language, when we talk about Christianity, note the word that we use. We use the word Christianity, when in fact there are Christianities. There's a big difference between Unitarians and Baptists and Evangelicals and conservative Catholics, you know, theologically, etc. So to use a singular term like Christianity gives the impression of this rather singular monolithic religious tradition. And I think we fall into that also sometimes when we talk about Islam.
Now, Islam is the second largest religion in the world, 1.5 billion, and is it's still the fastest growing?
Well, you know,
is that fair to say? There's
yeah,
some
all
question
of these
about
kind of competitive comments. I mean,
right.
I would put it this way: I would say that Islam is often identified as the fastest growing, but you could also say that it, in many ways, is in competition with evangelical and Baptist, particularly evangelical forms of Christianity, in terms of being the fastest growing. It's certainly the second largest of the world's religions, and indeed, it is considered by many people today to be larger than the largest of the Christian denominations, which is Roman Catholicism.
Now you are you came out of the Catholic tradition. I understand you went to seminary. Yes.
Yeah, I was at I definitely was in seminary for on and off for about 10 years. I was in a monastery. I was a Capuchin Franciscan, and I also my first degree, in fact, and teaching was as a Catholic theologian. I earned a master's degree at St. John's University in Catholic theology and taught Catholic theology for about 6 years before I went on to do a degree at Temple University, in which I majored in Islam and I minored in Hinduism and Buddhism.
How did you get interested in Islam?
Well, completely by accident. I mean, this was the late 60s, early 70s, and I then, as even many people today, but certainly then, had no knowledge of Islam or Muslims. And I went to Temple, actually, to do a PhD in religion, majoring in Catholic studies, because I was going to continue to remain in the area of Catholic studies. And then one of the requirements in Temple's program, which was different than any other school of religion, was no matter what you were going to major in, you had to do a course in world religions for a year. And so I got interested in Hinduism and Buddhism, and I was going to do a degree, finish it in Hinduism. And then the chairman of the department, who was American and Jewish, Bernard Phillips, said to me, we're hiring Muslims, and, you know, you ought to take a course. And this was 1967-68, and I had been raised in a total Italian-American neighborhood, but then my parents moved to a Jewish-American neighborhood, so all my friends were Jews. And at that time, with the 67 War, the Arab-Israeli 67 War, with Leon Uris's movie, the Exodus, which I thought was historical, which was a totally one-sided portrayal of history, I just thought, why would anybody want to study about Arabs and Muslims? So I was very reluctant. But there was, you know, a certain amount of what one would call collegial and bureaucratic pressure, i.e., the head of your department would really like you to do what
mm-hmm.
he says.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided, well, I'm married, I want to finish my degree quickly, let me take a course. And it blew my mind. I took a course, and I suddenly discovered that I knew the word Islam, but I suddenly discovered that, unlike what happened in those days, which was that on one side you had Christianity, and only marginally, it's changed a lot now, but Judaism included with Christianity under what we call the Judeo-Christian tradition, And then on the other
usually was the expression, Judeo-Christian.
Exactly, and which is a post-World War II phrase, actually.
Right.
And then on the other side, Islam was grouped with Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and suddenly I discovered, wait a minute, there's a problem here. Islam ought to be part of a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. And so I discovered a whole new, from my point of view, monotheistic reiteration, you know, or faith, which was part of what I call the Abrahamic tradition, and just got fascinated with it and never looked back.
We have a caller on line one from Urbana. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. You have a question or a comment for Professor Esposito.
Yes, thank you. I, of course, understand that the Quran is very central to Islam, and I'm wondering, is there any kind of literary or historical critical studies going on in the Quran? I haven't found an Oxford annotated Quran anywhere yet.
Yeah, I mean, there are historical critical studies of the Quran, I mean, done by individual scholars from both Muslim and non-Muslim, which would be regarded from, if you will, and I'm generalizing here because English words don't really communicate on this, from, if you will, the most progressive and some of them fairly aggressive kinds of analysis to others that are more, middle stream. But there's a lot of work out there. I think if you... I could be wrong, but I think if you Google something that says something like critical studies of the Quran, you'll get a cross-section. The only thing I would say is that you've got to really then look at, when you go to look at them, also then Google whoever the so-called author or scholar is to see whether or not they even have any scholarly background, however different they are. And if you can't find that, then email me and... I'll send you the names of some people who have done critical studies, of the Quran, who are both, again, both Muslim and non-Muslim.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Once more, a reminder to our listeners, if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for our guest this afternoon, Professor John Esposito, who is a University Professor of Religion and International Affairs at Georgetown University and Founding Director of the Prince Al-Walid bin Talal Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown, and has been, I guess, on a book tour for 2 years, is that right, for the future of Islam? My goodness.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it's been coming out in a lot of different languages, so I've been traveling around a lot.
You can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Now, you obviously developed and been working on the future of Islam long before the Arab Spring burst upon the scene, but I think you've described our own administration as being caught by surprise by the Arab Spring movement. I'm not sure exactly what the correct noun is that started in Egypt and Tunisia and has moved elsewhere. Were you yourself surprised by the Arab Spring, or did you see it coming?
Yeah, no, I was. I mean, I was surprised by the timing of it. I mean, if you go back and if anybody looks at my writing, I mean, for years I've talked about the realities of the fact that when people say, you know, is Islam compatible with democracy, or because there's no democracy in the Arab world or the Muslim world in general, is it due to culture or religion? I would always write and say, the problem is that you have authoritarian regimes, and that's why you don't have a democracy. And I would point out, certainly in the last few years, having been associated with the Gallup organization and the Gallup World Poll, that the hard data show that majorities of Muslims in some 35 countries wanted and admired America for its freedoms and wanted those freedoms and those, if you will, democratic values and rule of law. But in my writing, I would also point out that most of these governments, like Egypt and Tunisia and others, were entrenched in Libya for 20, 30, 40 years and Syria, and had incredible security and military forces, not the democratic system that kept them in power, and that these forces were often, not all, but certainly with the Tunisians and the Egyptians and others, supported by, funded by, trained by, equipped by the U.S. and some of the EU countries. So in my writing, I would talk about long-term, the inevitable change that would come, but never expecting that it would occur so proximately. And I think it's important to note that most of the young people and movements who got involved in Tunisia and Egypt, they did not expect that they were going to topple their governments, and certainly not topple them as quickly as they did. You know, they saw themselves as trying to be effective opposition voices, creating problems for their government. But nobody really had a sense of what could happen. And you know, what it was, when you look back, is that for so many people who had kind of given up on the fact that they had an ability to influence what kind of government they had.
Or to get a job. My impression, particularly
exactly.
In Egypt, was...
get a job and survive in a job. If they got a job, the concern was, if you would all differ with the government, you could lose your job. So, you know, but what suddenly happened was that people were, I think, large numbers of people were surprised when a significant minority actually went out and risked its livelihood and even their lives, and began to see that it was possible, not necessarily probable, to actually go out and bring down a government. And I think that's what happened in Tunisia and Egypt, and then, in a very fascinating way, in far more potentially violent governments, and they've stepped up to the plate and shown that they are, like Libya and Syria.
Right. How do you account for this change? I mean, what is there about the critical mass of young people that participated, that swelled to such a point that people like Mubarak literally had to go? It's just baffling to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it was baffling to Mubarak. Remember, when Mubarak gave his last speech, I think it was the next to last speech, when he should have known that everything was, going out of control, he fell back on the same old line and literally said to the people, not even appreciating what was going on in his country, you are my children, speaking
right.
Like, again, the patriarch.
Paternalism
know?
Was alive and well there.
Exactly, And even the military, they felt free, as some of the senior military, including the guy he designated to be his vice president, who then eventually got dumped, who said things like, well, our people aren't ready for democracy, so yeah, we'll have it in the future, but, it's like they're not ready, as if, we are. And I think what it was that, nobody really fully understood, except for this critical mass of young, entrepreneurial, social networking types, that with the modern technology, one could mount an opposition movement. Because remember, before this, to mount an opposition movement meant that you had to get control or get on the radio or television. Well, the government controlled that. Or that you had to go out in the public square. Well, the government would, make that was illegal. You had to get permission, and if you didn't, they'd come in and they'd wipe you out. But what the Internet really allowed people to do, and Facebook and Twitter, is whatever the government wanted to do, to figure out ways to communicate with people and to get around, if you will, the censors, if they did it well, and really mobilize people in a way that just wasn't conceivable. And governments were not, they hadn't conceived of it, so they really weren't in a position to do anything about it.
Well, of course, the technology certainly helped, but if there wasn't a critical mass of disaffection, it wouldn't have happened either.
Oh, precisely. I mean, the fact is, if you went to countries, again, like Egypt and Tunisia, it's not that a lot of people would have spoken to you if you were just a tourist, or whomever, because they would know that they couldn't trust you They wouldn't know whether or not you or the taxi cab driver that they were in the cab with you would be reporting them. But if you really were somebody who'd gone for years, you could see on the faces of people, and if you had friends and other contacts that you could meet with privately, you would see that in many cases, people were not ready to revolt because they were so damn depressed that there was no chance to do anything, that the government had so much power and it so entrenched itself. Again, I think, people ought to keep this in mind. A friend of mine in the Gulf sent me an email, and to kind of give a perspective on what the situation was like, he sort of said, the email said, "This is Egypt." And then it had a whole list of American presidents, maybe six. And they were all, of course, different faces and different people. And then next to it, for Egypt, it was Mubarak, 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 right. Mubarak. The same thing could be said of Libya, 40 years. And so for most of these people, there was a conviction that this is what it's like, and we better accept it, because what we want to do is kind of live, not be thrown in jail. We want to survive. We want our families to get by. And if you were young, it was, there's no sense in taking on, becoming part of an opposition, because who's going to come out in the street with me and look at the odds in what I'm up against? And I think what happened with the social internetting was that suddenly people were able to connect and realize how, as they got to talk to each other, how there was widespread discontent and how there was a critical mass, a vanguard, not a huge number, but a significant vanguard that was really ready to step up to the plate. And then what made it even more astonishing was that when they went out, that others began to see this and realize that, oh my God, it's not as if I step out in the street, there'll be nobody coming out with me, or there'll only be two people. And that's why places like Tahrir Square became so symbolic, because it became a place where people didn't have to feel that I go out my street and yell down with Mubarak, and of right. course there's silence, but rather if I go down there, there are a lot of people that are already out in opposition, and I can join that kind of movement. And, that's what makes a big difference. And so if you do that and then you're under pressure or you're being accosted by police, et cetera, when you're part of a group and you have a kind of group sense, it enables people to feel more empowered. And people took risks, and lots of people gave up lives. I mean, more than 1,000 people in Syria have been killed. Hundreds and hundreds were killed in Egypt. So, we don't want to forget that, in order to win this, it meant that, a fair number of people went out intelligently knowing that they were risking being injured or killed, and minimally, if it failed, never having a job in their future, and maybe their family not having a job and disappearing in a prison.
Those are pretty high stakes.
Yeah.
Has it failed or has it succeeded in Egypt?
I think it's too soon to tell. I would certainly say, there are people who say things like, this is my own opinion, but I find it really funny. I was just with some people recently, and they meant well, but they said, we don't know what the next government can be like. And I keep thinking, my God, that's true. And you have to be concerned. But there are two things to remember. During President Clinton's term, President Mubarak came to the United States, and almost no media, was barely covered in our press. Major human rights organization put out a study saying, with regard to Mubarak and human rights, 10 years of torture. So, when people say, what will the next government be like? Look at the previous governments. They're governments that controlled, as in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya and Syria, controlled governments for 20 to 40 years. 20 to 40 years. And during that period, repressed, oppressed, violated the human rights, put in thousands upon thousands of people in prison, killed, tortured them in the most gruesome ways. So, to say that you don't want to deal with a transition that has an unknown, as if what went on before wasn't so horrendous that one would have to be pretty damn good to get beyond it. And then the other thing to realize is that wouldn't people have said the same thing with the American Revolution? I mean, wouldn't those who supported the Brits, as well as those who supported the Brits and the King, say, here you've got these rebels, what kind of people are there? They're all of these, many of them malcontents, who of course left Britain because, well, they were being persecuted, but one doesn't want to sort of say that. And we're going to have incredible chaos. So should we have this? And of course we had a revolution in which there was a lot of bloodshed, and even worse than that, what we forget, is that years later, we had a civil war in which 600,000 or more people were killed. So, you know, if we look at the reality of what it takes to have significant and political social change historically, especially where you've had a kind of entrenched authoritarian government, we certainly know that these things are a crapshoot. But I think that if we look at Egypt, while there have been some problems, there's also been progress. I mean, for example, the fact that the younger generation has refused to allow the military to simply run things, but has gone out in the streets when it's necessary and now gotten the military to actually have the government bring Mubarak up on charges with regard to whether or not he didn't order the killing of people is really pretty remarkable. And yes, there are going to be fights and debates within Egypt and among political parties about what the future looks like, what role should religion play, etc. But again, that's exactly what our own country went through.
We have a caller on line one from Champaign. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment for Professor Esposito?
Hi, first I have a comment. I'm in Faith in Place, which is a state organization where we work on the environment, and we're working with the Muslims and having great luck in lobbying and other projects like gardens. What can people do, like the imams that in civil courts, to get justice for being taken off the plane?
That's a very good question. I mean, I wouldn't even say somewhat concerned, very concerned, that the reality of it is that, and just for your listeners, they should be clear on this, I was a strong supporter of President Obama. I'm still a strong supporter in that I feel that, as far as I can tell on the horizon, whatever the differences and debates in the country, he's probably our best bet. But I have disagreed, and if you look at Huffington Post or On Faith, I have disagreed with, regrettably, with a fair amount of the president's approach internationally and nationally on these issues. That is, that in a number of critical ways, I don't see much of a difference between the Obama administration at times and the Bush administration. And certainly on the issue of civil liberties, there is some movement, but the administration is nowhere near as aggressive as it can be. And I think that part of what needs to happen is for Americans, obviously, a primary group has to be Muslim Americans themselves, because I know as an Italian American, and many of us who come from minority groups in the past, that if you want to bring about change, you can hope that other Americans will come on board, but you better be out there leading and not just expecting somebody to do it for you. But on the other hand, I think we just need a lot more non-Muslim Americans to step up to the plate. And part of the problem that you have is, as I said earlier, that this astonishing thing where, you know, if you ask Americans, you know, what do you admire about Islam and Muslims, 50 or more percent say nothing or I don't know. And then if you ask them how much they know about Islam, many of them, more than 50% at times, will say, well, I really ought to know more, but they don't do anything about it. And if you ask them about their prejudice, many will admit that their prejudice towards Muslims is twice their prejudice towards any other religion. So I think that, you know, part of what we need to do, those of us who are non-Muslims, and this is what I see part of my role, is to really, you know, become involved in fact, trying to both inform better members of our neighborhoods and our community, but also to become more involved in what are the civil liberties issues that are involved here. And indeed, from the Bush administration to the Obama administration, in the name of, at times, pursuing terrorists, and we do need to pursue terrorists aggressively, the majority of people who wind up often getting nailed are people who, at the end of the day, prove not to be that. And I think that until we start saying that when government officials or airlines violate the civil liberties of people, they ought to really be aggressively pursued and punished for it, rather than that you wind up with an airline having screwed up multiple times on some of these cases, simply saying something like, "We apologize." Well, that might have worked right after 9/11 because you'd figure people hadn't gotten their moorings on how to proceed. But this is 10 years later, and I think we need to be very concerned about this.
Christianity has had its moments of reform, but it has not always, I guess it's fair to say, is reform has not always been alive and well. But you say that Islamic reformism is and always has been alive and well. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I would qualify that a little. I would say that Islamic reformism, like Christian reformism, is present, exists, but is not been as alive and well as some would think or like. I would say that it has lagged behind Christianity for a number of reasons. The example I often give it is, by the way, the difference between Protestantism and Catholicism. Catholicism's real moment of reform came with Vatican II, and that was in the late 1960s, which is remarkable in that it was 50 to 80 years, conservatively speaking, after the kinds of reforms that were occurring in Protestantism. That is that in the late 19th and early 20th century, you had papal documents called papal bulls that would, for example, condemn what was called modernism. And modernism include everything from modern biblical criticism to the notion of gender equality, of freedom of the press, democracy, which was seen as leading to anarchy, and also even the notion of pluralism. Roman Catholicism was very comfortable with the idea that in Catholic countries or Catholic-dominated countries, that indeed Catholicism would completely dominate. And even into the 20th century, after reforms were beginning to occur in Catholicism in countries like Spain under Franco and Portugal under Salazar, because Catholicism was the, if you will, official or entrenched religion, other religions, Protestantism, etc., had incredible restrictions on them, the kind of restrictions that exist at times in Egypt with regard to Christians, needing special permission to build a church or to repair a church, etc. The problem with reform in Islam, and a reformist movement began in the late 19th and it's existed in the 20th century, but reformism has been difficult because reform in the West occurred out of a Western context and took years. If you think about, for example, the Industrial Revolution, the Enlightenment, and then even after the Enlightenment, you know, when you talk about the Enlightenment and the Reformation, you then had the Counter-Reformation, 100 years of religious wars. That all occurred in a Western context. For Muslim countries, they went through a couple of centuries of colonialism. Well, under European colonial rule, you did not have the space or the freedom for what reform takes place. And then when most Muslim countries got independence, the governments that they got were kings, military, and ex-military. So there have been a lot of constraints on that reform. But as I argue in my book, The Future of Islam, and I have a whole chapter on it, Chapter 3, reform is taking place in the Muslim world today. It is a vanguard. It's not, you know, the overwhelming force right now, because as in reform in any religion, and certainly in Catholicism, it begins with a vanguard in a tradition that is, you know, very conservative. The example I like to give of the dynamics of reform and how diverse it is if you look at Judaism. Judaism, after the process of reform, still winds up with American Jewish groups with names like Orthodox, Ultra-Orthodox, conservative, reform, reconstructionist, etc., representing that this process is a very complex and contentious process, because usually when reform occurs in a tradition, the majority of religious leaders and followers are people who followed in an interpretation of their religion that's existed for centuries. And so reformers have an uphill battle. And I think that's occurring in Islam today.
Talk a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Doesn't reform exist within that movement even today?
Yeah. And I think a lot of people missed it. One of the problems that arises...
Fox News missed it big time.
Excuse me?
Fox News missed that big time. They just went...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, well, Fox News misses a lot big time, but that's Fox News.
Right.
But the reality of it is that, you know, we tend to lump together everything together. So there's a tendency with the Fox people to lump the Muslim Brotherhood together with Hamas and Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda, right, even. The reality of it is that for the last 30 to 40 years, and this is something that your listeners can just check on the Internet, the Muslim Brotherhood has functioned within Egyptian society as a nonviolent movement, despite the fact that if you look at international human rights reports, if you look at State Department human rights reports, one will see that they were among the major groups that during the Mubarak regime, along with other opposition and reform movements, that were arrested, tortured, repressed, often before elections. Many of the top candidates were arrested 6 months ahead of time. And they've managed to, stay within mainstream society. Now, there are problems with the Muslim Brotherhood, as with a lot of movements. That is, you have an older generation that is, from my point of view, far too conservative. But you also have a younger generation that is far more flexible and is struggling for reform. And if the Brotherhood does not respond as reformist as it should, then what they will discover is that they will have problems. And so what we see now is a debate within the Brotherhood itself between a younger and an older generation about how to proceed. The younger generation tends to be far more, if you will, modern and inclusive. So, for example, some of the younger generation leaders will talk about the fact that, look, in a modern nation state, the head of the country should be, where you have equality of citizenship, the head of the country should be able to be a Coptic Christian or a woman. Your more conservative types will have a problem with that. We don't have to look much farther than our own country. Conservative Christians would argue that only a Christian should be president of the United States.
Certainly no atheists or Muslims.
Exactly. Or Buddhists or Hindus.
You mentioned in that third chapter, which I think personally is the most interesting of the book, on reform, some names. Let me just mention something and say something briefly about them. Tariq Ramadan.
Right. Tariq Ramadan is somebody who is the grandson of the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, although Tariq was born and educated in Switzerland, has a Western PhD. He's now a professor at Oxford University. He is both an intellectual and an activist, and if one, for example, goes to Amazon.com, one can see all the books that he does and, you know, pick out what he's written on. But he's written extensively in recent years on Islamic reform, and he has a rather large following in Europe and America, but also overseas in many Muslim countries. He's not the only reformer. He's not necessarily, as with reformers, we're all human. He's not necessarily, the only voice out there and right every time, but he's out there. His most recent book, or one of his most recent books, is called Radical Reform. He's one of the more interesting people to look at. He's somebody who struggles with the idea, as most Jewish and Christian reformers did. Okay, we've got a tradition that endured for centuries. Now we have new times, how do we reinterpret our religious tradition to bring about, you know, change, and change that's authentic, but also change that is significantly different and can respond to the new social and political context.
Talk about Amina Wadud.
Oh, Amina Wadud is a African-American Muslim. Her father is a Christian minister, I believe a Baptist minister. She's a longtime convert to Islam, written a very groundbreaking and provocative book on women and the Quran, which is published by Oxford University Press, and in fact is a reformist voice. She received a lot of attention a number of years ago because she was among the first Muslim women in North America to lead a mixed prayer. The official, the Friday prayer in Islam is the community prayer,
right.
And traditionally it is led by men if it's a mixed group. Women can lead women, but she, in New York City, led a mixed group in that prayer. Her thinking is a reformist, and it's groundbreaking, but it's also, as a result of that, provocative among, more conservative Muslims.
We just have a few minutes left here. If you'd like to call in with a comment or question to Professor John Esposito, who is talking with us about a book he's written entitled The Future of Islam, you can call in at 333-9455. We also have an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Amina Wadud coined the term gender jihad, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, she was one of the earliest people, and in fact, also a Muslim woman taking up that title, Hiba Abu Ghudairi, wrote a chapter in a book that I edited on women in Islam, also on this notion of gender jihad, meaning the gender struggle within Islam, the struggle with regard to women's role within Islam in modern times, and dealing with notions of not only equality but also notions of Quranic interpretation, because Islam, very much like all the great world religions, Judaism and Christianity, the interpretation of those religious traditions took place within patriarchal societies. The religion was revealed in a patriarchal society. The early theologians and legal scholars were males, and so the good old boys interpreted, what religion was about and what gender relations were about. And so today they talk about the gender jihad, meaning the struggle to revisit and to reinterpret the whole question of gender relations.
I wonder if gender jihad is in the minds of the protesting Saudi women who are driving their own cars in Riyadh.
Oh, sure. And also the Saudi women who go beyond the driving, but, the Saudi women who press more for equal representation within society, in terms of the corporate sector, et cetera, because Saudi women can have their, own companies, but they are, it's still within the notion of sexual segregation. And, what you're talking about now for many of the reformers is much more of a recognition of the role that women can play. And so, for example, it's very interesting in the corporate sector, Lubna Olayan, who's the head of an enormous company that her father founded years ago, you have a woman in the family rather than a male who's the head of this giant corporation, and only recently, within the last few years, became a major player within a major group of Saudi business people. That is, the first woman to be a very, very senior member of this, this closed circle.
Do you see an upwelling within Saudi Arabia or other conservative regimes in the Arab Muslim region of the Middle East? One of the things we haven't talked about is that probably many more Muslims are non-Arab than Arab. Isn't that right?
Yeah, only 23% of Arabs. The largest number are in Asia. I think it's Saudi Arabia, yes. I mean, I think that the Saudis, they have engaged in reform, but the fact is that the Saudis are very concerned about this Arab Spring. We know that reports are that the Saudi government was very upset with the U.S. government for not backing and staying backing Mubarak because they're concerned about, you know, the notion of regime change and how that could play out in their own country. And indeed, they have been very active and aggressive in trying to mobilize other governments in the Gulf to be supportive of the government of Bahrain, in which you have a minority government of Sunni Muslims who dominate two-thirds of the country are Shia and who have resisted reform using an incredible amount of violence. Saudi Arabia wants to reform, but I think that to a certain degree, but on the other hand, the message coming out of the policies is to use economic goodies and promises, et cetera, to put off discontent that would lead to significant political reform.
Right.
But I think it's inevitable that for many of these monarchies, down the line, whether it's the next 5 years or the next 10 years, they're going to have to face a notion of a moving towards a constitutional monarchy, or they're going to have major problems.
Now, we have a little over a minute left. The last part of your book focuses on new ways forward. To quote Obama, what are some new ways forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect that we need to focus on in this
country?
Well,
I think the foundation stone has to be that every country operates on national interest. But if we want to be credible, whether it's our country or the democracies of the EU, that national interest also has to be connected to the very principles that we say we not only espouse and stand for, that we promote in other parts of the world, but that we have not promoted in the Arab and Muslim world. As President Bush said in his second term, where his administration said, we, the America, regardless of our presidents, has practiced democratic exceptionalism in the Middle East. So the way forward is to promote our national interest, but within a context of partnerships, not unilateral leadership, and one that is based on also our notions of self-determination and human rights.
Professor Esposito, it's been a delight talking with you and very much enjoyed when you came here back in April. And thank you very, very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you. I had a great time.
It was very enlightening. We've been talking to Professor John Esposito, one of America's leading authorities on Islam. He's written a book about 2 years ago entitled The Future of Islam, and we've been talking about the issues about American and Western understanding of Islam and ways to think about the future. We will see you again next week on Keeping the Faith. Steve should be back. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
I've been a part of WILL Book Mentor Project.
It's a feeling that I never had in my life. And the reason I'm doing this is because I want him to grow up and do the same thing when he has his own kids.
My name is Shoni Coleman. WILL is my source for opportunities to interact with my son and other children.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.